Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Government vs. the Robots, the fortnightly podcast that takes a look at how technology will influence politics in the future. I'm Jonathan Tanner and this week I'm going to be talking to Roland Manthorpe. Roland is a technology correspondent at Sky News. We're going to be talking about how technology journalism has evolved, looking at Huawei and deepfakes, and asking what the biggest developments we can expect in technology and politics are in 2019.
Hi, I'm Roland. I'm technology correspondent at Sky News. I used to be senior editor at Wired.
Roland, it's great to have you here. This is the first podcast we've ever recorded in my home of South London. So we're both sat in Peckham. There is a six-month-old baby upstairs above us. Not my baby, I hasten to add. But if anybody hears any crying in the background, it's not our production assistant. It's just the fact that we're recording in Peckham. So it's great to have you here today. How long have you been at Sky now?
4 months, I think. Yeah, it feels both like a really long time and a really, really short time.
Are you enjoying being on the TV?
Yes, sometimes. Sometimes it's just, it's honestly exhilarating. That is the word. Sometimes it's so terrifying. But I say when you do live events and you're there with a TV camera. So I did the Google walkout and the Uber protests. And you just think, this is incredible. I wouldn't want to be covering this in any other way than with a TV camera, because that's how you can convey what the event is about in the truest form, rather than, say, you know, taking some notes, going back to office, writing it up. And then other times, it's just so confusing and difficult, and you can't believe how hard it is to make TV. It's so sort of weird and artificial as well. I mean, all these forms are artificial, but you notice it more when you're getting used to it. So, I'm sort of slowly acclimatizing, I think.
And before you came to Sky, you were writing for Wired magazine. And we're writing on technology issues for a good 2 or 3 years, probably. Can you tell me when in your life the penny dropped that tech was going to be this thing that you wanted to spend time really kind of getting underneath?
Yeah, good question. I think, yeah, definitely with tech, everyone thinks it happened earlier than it really did. You know, like everyone always thinks they were into Google in like the late 90s. No, they weren't. They were into it in the mid 2000s, maybe. But I think it was around like 2010 or 2011. I actually really got the startup bug. And I really believed in the things that people were saying around that time about startups and changing the world and doing things differently. And it just suddenly struck me like, wow, this is for real. And then I started writing a lot more about it and hanging out around startups and writing about tech in a quite kind of positive way. And before that, I had a background in policy and I studied history and politics. And around, I guess, like 2014, it was like the two halves of my background just clicked. Because it was like, wow, tech is suddenly getting really political. And I felt like I saw that quite early on. And then at Wired, I set up Wired's first ever sort of tech and politics vertical. And I launched a tech and politics podcast and did loads and loads of stuff and made Wired a lot more political. And it felt like, all right, yeah, I can. This is something I'm not technical, but I know politics maybe better than the tech people. I know tech better than the politics people. And also, having been on that journey as well with tech, you know, there's a part of me which is still so optimistic about it all, or wishes that I could be optimistic. And yeah, so I've seen the move from crazy optimism to extreme pessimism, and watched that as it's changed.
And do you feel vindicated in feeling that tech was going to get political? And by extension, kind of how do your colleagues at Sky feel about having a tech correspondent? I think you're the first.
The second. I think they're probably confused. And that's because actually tech journalism is quite young. And a tech correspondent is quite a new thing, really. So unusually for me, I don't have any competitors at ITV or Channel 4. They don't have tech correspondents. And obviously I have like a view of what the role should be. But there are lots of different ways to cover tech. And yeah, and there aren't that many established role models out there to look to, especially not on the TV side. But yeah, and mostly my idea of how it should be is something a bit closer to economics correspondent. You know, because the economics correspondent, what they're really telling you is about the hidden levers that move the world. And tech, people don't know, but tech is as important as economics right now. It's only going to get more important. And so, yeah, that's what I want to get across to people. And yeah, of course, I feel massively vindicated. I said it all along, and it totally turned out to be true.
Well, while you're basking in that glory, I wanted to ask about whether you think the fact that, and hopefully, maybe it seems obvious, presumably the fact that Sky have decided they want a tech correspondent is a sign that people and the public are starting to realise that these are issues that matter and deserve their own focus?
I hope so. That would be nice, wouldn't it? I mean, yeah, I don't really know. Although, so the first thing that happened when I spoke to Sky, they approached me and I had one of those weird coffees, you know, where you're, because you're still working at your current job, and you think, oh, well, I'll go along to see what this might be like. And we talked about it. And the first thing I said was, I don't want to do gadgets. And they were like, great, because we don't want gadgets either. And I feel like that sort of set the tone in a way, because basically at the start, tech journalism was gadgets. And then it became about obsessing about how big companies were and how they worked, about startups. And now I feel like we're sort of in a more mature phase. I mean, seriously, actually, the idea of holding tech companies to account honestly feels like it's not that old. I mean, I don't want to insult any of the brilliant tech journalists who always did this, but it feels like people have only really got onto that in the last few years and about getting what's really going on out there. And yeah, I mean, it's really exciting to be part of that.
Where do you think we are on the kind of collision course between technology and politics? So I feel like Government versus the Robots and the people that listen to it regularly have recognised that tech's getting increasingly political and it's shaping the political environment. But I don't think that idea's gone mainstream, and I certainly don't think tech's had an effect on how people are thinking about which political party they might support. So on the kind of journey where tech and politics merge, let's assume they're going to merge more and more, where on that journey do you think we are?
Well, this is possibly slightly self-serving, but I think we're just at the beginning. It really is day one in all this, because I think that we're at the start of something that's as significant as the Industrial Revolution or the sort of the financial revolution that made money part of the economy in the 17th century. So tech is going to massively carry on changing politics, but it won't necessarily change politics in this narrow way that we all understand. It's like you know, in the midterms in the US, everyone sort of breathed this sigh of relief that it came off successfully, but it's like, well, the change has already happened and is still happening in so many different ways. And it's also that tech is getting into other parts of the economy and other parts of society and changing, for instance, like retail. The high street is really, really, really dying. And tech is part of that. It's not the full story, but it's a really big part of that. I mean, and if you think of a life without sort of shops on the high street, now that is politically incredibly important. And it's politically important not just for elections, but for people's lives. And the same with, you know, driverless cars. Imagine if we actually did get driverless cars and the sort of waves of unemployment that might cause. And also the angry the politics that you might get about it. So, yeah, I feel like we're really just the beginning, but also that we don't understand how it's going to change politics. Because sometimes when you just look at the political world, yeah, it still seems like the same, except there's more tweeting and the Facebook ads are really dark. But it's like once this change takes hold, and it's getting into geopolitics as well, right? Like the whole Huawei, China, US trade war, cyber is integral to that. But we don't understand how it's going to change it because, yeah, just like with those previous revolutions, people didn't understand either.
So there you have it. If you've ever wanted to feel like a true pioneer, if you've listened to every episode of Government versus the Robots, you are a true pioneer on the tech and politics journey. You heard it here first. And we're going to take a little look forward into 2019 in a moment. But before we do, I wonder, Roland, what you feel the most significant developments in the tech world in 2018 were.
That's actually quite easy because it was Cambridge Analytica. That just opened up, I think, this space of tech and politics, and it brought it out into the open. And it's weird, that one, because I feel like in the tech world, when Cambridge Analytica first came out, a lot of people just said, oh, so you mean you didn't know about that? But people didn't. And it's the connection with Trump as well. And in fact, like some of those connections, I sort of wonder about the exact correlation there. But whatever, it's sort of, it's got people understanding that something is really going on. And that event, both in its sort of symbolic and actual nature, feels incredibly important. I will look back on that as a landmark. I suppose you could say, what else could you say? GDPR? Nah. No, it's definitely Cambridge Analytica.
So we're going to play a little game where we take a look forward into 2019. So I was conscious that I don't want you to give away all of your best stories that you're hoping will drop throughout 2019, but I did want to get a sense from you of how you think the year is going to play out. So I've got a few different issues jotted down here in my notes, and I'm going to give you the latitude to score them out of 10 in terms of their likely significance and importance in 2019. And I encourage you to be ballsy in your predictions. So let's hear some zeros, let's hear some tens in with the average seven. So first off is the health impacts of mobile phones on a scale of 0 to 10.
2.
I saw a story that said something like 1 in 10 Chinese people are now suffering from short-sightedness. Is that due to looking at screens? Definitely 2.
Oh, I think it's actually a lot more than 1 in 10. I thought it was like 50%. Yeah, because myopia is something that you develop. And yeah, by spending a lot of time reading and indoors and staring at screens, yeah, you can just develop it. But although I think that maybe in the long term, this could be really important, because ultimately, if people start to think that tech is like smoking, that is really going to get through. But short term, the evidence base just isn't there. And the positive advantages just mean that everyone's going to carry on using it all the time. I mean, this year, we've already had one report out about screen time, which is a big fascination of politicians. It's something people like to talk about. And what that report showed was that it depends what you're using that screen time for. I don't think it's going to produce those really hard, immediate stories that are going to make a difference this year.
What about, it feels to me like we're not that far away from a video or some form of media that is a fake, but it's such a good fake that everybody gets caught hook, line and sinker. So let's go with like politically significant fake video, 0 to 10.
So I'm going to say 3, but only because I kind of think this already exists, right, doesn't it? Like, I mean, fake news has already basically won a presidential election. But for some reason, we've got all excited about deep fakes and fake videos. Like, yeah, sure, there probably will be one in 2019, and everyone will go absolutely nuts about it, and there'll be all these stories about fake news. It's here, it's now. You know, it's been here for ages. It's real already. And also, I think in the sort of economics of all this, ultimately, text is way more dominant than people thought. Text is still the dominant mode of communication online, and As anyone who does this sort of stuff will know, creating really effective tech stuff is easier than creating effective video stuff. So maybe on the production side, there won't be that much of it. But yeah, I mean, I'm sure it'll happen. I'm sure I'll be covering this story endlessly, because in a way, it's more fascinating perhaps for the media than it is for everyone out there.
I'm putting that at 7. And I'm putting money on you standing up on Sky News next year, reporting on a story that is generated by a fake, totally fake piece of content. Because I think there's potential for it to be done in a way that the cat gets quite a long way out of the bag before anybody realised it was fake. So I remember a little while ago, there was a great set of fake sketches from Bill Clinton or Tony Blair's memoirs, and it was conversations that were meant to have happened between the two of them in the car, and they were absolutely hilarious. And I think it took a good sort of 12 hours before everybody realised. Now, that's you know, just a bit of text, but I think I could see a world in which the same could happen with a piece of content that generated a national news story where people didn't realise it was fake until the cat was well out of the bag.
I completely agree, and I'm sure that will happen. But I think in a way this actually relates to a sort of a perspective on tech. There's this great book by this guy, David Edgerton, called The Shock of the Old. And basically he says that our entire approach to looking at the history of tech is wrong. We tend to focus on innovations, newness, when we should be focusing on use. So one of the things he talks about is that corrugated iron is one of the most important inventions of the last 200 years because it's used on the roof of every shantytown in the world. So it basically enables shantytowns. But instead, people obsess about VR because it's new. And my sense is that I like to look at the use and what's really going on out there. And actually, yeah, out there, things are a lot simpler and cruder than really sophisticated deep fakes. So while it's fascinating for us because it's new and the media loves newness and it seems significant, I wonder. But I mean, you're absolutely right. I'm sure I'll be covering it because it's a spectacle. And TV and the media, that's what we're good at. Good at spectacle.
Okay, let's go with bias algorithms.
Do you mean the notion of biased algorithms? As in, say, like, the idea that algorithms are racist? Or actual biased algorithms in the wild, like YouTube? So actual biased algorithms in the wild, like... So YouTube radicalization is real and incredibly important. I would score that a 9. The notion that algorithms are racist, a 0. Because even though for me, it feels like just a fact that we should all know and incredibly important and urgent and significant, it is so, so, so far from being on people's minds and in the public consciousness to a level where it might create political impact. And I've been doing some work recently which has sort of involved me like getting out and about and spending a lot of time in citizens' advice bureaus and in community law centres, talking to people about this very thing. And I had a conversation with someone who really got it, and they were really smart, and they really kind of were listening. And I explained to them about the way that data could be used to generate a scoring system on say, so that you might score someone on how likely they were to be long-term missing. This is something that happens. Or how likely they were to re-offend, or something that happens in the UK. And they listened really carefully, and they said, no, I don't think it'll be anyone here because they don't use the internet. And I was like, oh, yeah, okay. My explanation didn't include the fact that you don't need to use the internet for someone to have loads of data on you, the council data, your life data. But they just thought there's something that happened online. And that's what I mean. I just think, you know, so to go from there to biased algorithms, it's miles away.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Let's go with the use of drones by nefarious actors.
Tricky. I think... Oh, God, I don't want to give this a high score. I think 8. I'm sorry. So covering that Gatwick drone thing... I just spoke to a lot of drone experts and they told me so many terrible, horrible stories about things that are currently happening in places like Syria and Yemen. And it made me really pessimistic and worried about all this. So sorry, I think it will be important.
Let's move on quickly because things got gloomy here in the kitchen. The hacking of significant public infrastructure.
6. Not because I think that if it happened, it wouldn't be incredibly important. But because I wonder about its likelihood. Does that make sense? So, as in, if it happens, 10. If it doesn't happen, than actually two, because I think that, again, the sort of real understanding about hacks and what they mean, I don't understand. What does the fact that everything gets hacked mean politically? It feels like, the answer that you get from security services is that it means that we're all on the front line now and everyone needs to have better cybersecurity training, which seems to mean that we need stronger passwords. And that doesn't feel like a politically potent fact. But if there is a hack and if it is by a major nation state, well, that would be incredibly significant, because it would take things onto a geopolitical level. And I feel like there is this sort of mounting sense of conflict around that, which is, yeah, quite concerning, really.
Presumably the China Huawei story, the kind of idea that it seems to me, reading between the lines, that China is putting itself in a position where it can glean as much information that could put it at an advantage all over the world. And perhaps that shouldn't really be a surprise. But when bits of UK infrastructure are potentially going to be under the control of Chinese companies, who are by extension under the control of the Chinese government, that feels like a kind of whole new ball game from trying to protect your own intellectual property in the British Isles.
Yeah, it does. On the other hand, what have Huawei done? What crime have they committed? What's changed recently? What's changed is the political climate. This is part of Trump's trade war, really. And more generally, the statements that people like the FBI and the US State Department give on this, they're incredibly clear in a way that our government isn't. They say China wants to become an economic superpower and we cannot let that happen. In a sense, it's already happened. But, I mean, to give him his due, China's hurting a lot more from this trade war than the US. So I feel like the measures that America is taking have been very effective. And essentially, when you see someone like Germany or France, both two countries which are apparently looking at banning Huawei from their 5G networks, when they do that, that's pressure from the US. The message has gone out there. And yeah, maybe from a theoretical point of view, it does make sense. But my concern about this, which may be not very useful if you're on the ground and making decisions about this, but my concern is that there's something about this kind of rising sense of conflict and this sort of weaponization of every aspect of life, and the fact that we're in this sort of cyber conflict. War isn't declared on the basis of anything. It's just grinds constantly on the basis of hypotheticals. I find that a worrying way of dealing with the situation, and I'm concerned that we're getting sucked into this narrative, because ultimately, I mean, you know, the world we want to get to is a world of mutual interdependence where we can work with each other, and that is going to involve China, and that is going to involve Chinese tech. So just banning them right now at this stage, I mean, well, I don't know, maybe it makes sense. Although the former director of GCHQ, Robert Hannigan, he says he thinks it's ridiculous. I mean, but then again, this is another difficulty, is that as a journalist, it's very frustrating because it often comes down to the secret papers that we can't see. That's often feels like what you're being told. So anyway, I don't know. I resist this narrative because I feel like it has political motives behind it, and I don't like the way we're getting sucked into it.
Last one, and I know it might be for you a hope as much as an expectation. The further demise of Facebook.
The further demise of Facebook. So there's going to be loads of stories about Facebook, and there's going to be an ongoing sense of crisis about them. But, I mean, demise, 3, because it's not going to happen. However, I did used to say that Mark Zuckerberg would never, ever come close to being ousted as CEO of Facebook. And now I feel like it could be a possibility. Although, it was interesting, I was at this thing with Martin. Do you see this thing, Martin Lewis versus Facebook, how he sort of got Facebook to combat scam ads and give 3 million to citizens of Vice. And that was really weird, because normally the relationship that you have with Facebook is quite confrontational. They don't like to admit they're wrong. And instead, they held a whole big press conference to basically say that they'd got this wrong in the past, and they're really pleased to announce they were doing something. So you can really see that in 2019, they've decided to turn a page and own the narrative. And I suppose to a certain extent, they managed to do that with that story. Although, I don't know, I mean, they're such a terrible company in terms of the things that they do, that it's hard to see how they can escape getting into more and more trouble this year, just like last year.
If you want to know more about Roland's views on Facebook, do look up his open letter to Mark Zuckerberg, which you can find on the Wired website. I'm conscious we didn't hit many 10s there, so I'm going to ask you in a moment what you feel like might be a 10 for 2019. But before you do, some of those issues which we talked about just there are covered in other episodes of Government versus the Robots. So we do have an episode called Flying Pizza Deliveries, which feels a little bit benign, talking about the potential use and misuse of drones in the future. We've talked about data and algorithms on several episodes with Jamie Bartlett. We've talked about virtual reality and fakes on the episode Real Reality. And we've talked about the news ecosystem last week on Democracy Hacked, but we've also talked about it on an episode called Fake News and All That Jazz. So if you've not managed to listen to all of those back episodes, please do have a wheel through. Follow up any of those issues in more depth. Roland, what are your 10 out of 10s for 2019 in terms of things that you think you're almost certainly going to be reporting on that are going to be the big stories of the next year?
I think that 2019 is going to be the year that government start to take action on tech. Because actually, if you think about it, there's been a lot of noise, but what's really happened? What laws have been passed? What laws have been changed? There's been one, essentially, GDPR. And that, in its sort of incoherent, bureaucratic, difficult way, has already had a really big effect. But 2019 is going to be the year when actually governments do things. So in the UK, the government's working on a white paper about regulating content online. And that's going to be big and important, but also, is that it's not like the state is a useful, benevolent actor necessarily. I'm just thinking it's possible they might completely screw it up as get it right. But you'll start seeing kind of greater intervention. And I think it's going to happen right across the world. And so in a sense, we're starting to see this conflict rising between the state and big tech, which in its own way has been taking over aspects of the state for some time. And that's the real conflict that I think will shape what's going to happen in the future. And we'll look back at this and think, they really did get that wrong at first. Or maybe they'll think that was incredibly smart regulation and action needs to be taken, and it was. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. This is what I'm really interested to see. But I think that whatever happens, it's going to cause a lot of conflict, and ultimately that will matter for politics and matter for journalists like me.
And we're recording this episode on a day that it's been announced that Sky News is going to record everything that happens in its newsroom for a 24-hour period. And that got me thinking while you were on your way over here about the nature of surveillance and transparency, because this is a big exercise in transparency from Sky's point of view. But for all of the staff, they will also feel a sense of surveillance. And I know that with the growth of tech, there are greater and greater opportunities for surveillance, whether that's the big data hoovering exercises that Google and Facebook and others are doing on a day-to-day basis. And people might question the purpose of the 10-year challenge meme and everybody sharing their faces 10 years later all over social media and who that benefits. But I read a book, Jonathan Franzen novel called Purity, a couple of years ago, in which a politician has to wear a camera on their head 24/7 in order to be able to show that she was exercising absolute transparency at all times. And it feels to me like some people want more transparency, but to deliver more transparency increasingly through modern tech, you also allow for more surveillance. And I just wonder if you feel like the relationship between surveillance and tech, so surveillance and transparency, is something that kind of we need to keep an eye on.
That's a really good question, which requires you could do a whole podcast just on that. I think that what you need to unpack a little bit this relationship between surveillance and transparency, because I think what crucially matters is who is doing the surveillance, who the surveillance is for, and likewise with the transparency, who does it serve? Those are the political questions about those practices. And say with the Sky thing, so it's for Sky's 30th anniversary, which is on the 5th of February. And yeah, I don't know how it's going to be. Maybe it'll be terrible. Maybe it'll be really embarrassing. Maybe a bit boring. I don't know. But definitely I personally feel that journalists don't really do a very good job at explaining what they do to people in the world. I mean, journalists are always going on about the media. And obviously, because we publish a lot and put a lot out there, we think that people understand what we do. They don't. I bet people have no idea what a source is. And also, I bet how often, that for me, like the balance I'm often trying to strike is the stuff that I do publish versus stuff I don't publish. Like, I know so much more than I can publish. And that is kind of, that's quite key to responsible journalism. And that's sort of, that's what you learn, you know, there's a whole craft around it. So yeah, basically, I quite like the idea. Because also, I'm just, you know, I'm up for a try of anything. There were large questions about surveillance and transparency. Because I think that there is a middle point, which we can arrive at. In that we're not necessarily stuck in this kind of this binary where if we let out information, then it's going to be used against us. And the way I think about it is this is through data and the open data movement, which I'm still really, really, really believe in. And I wish that more people did and more people understand the importance of it. And just to give one example, mapping data in the UK is not open. It's owned initially by the ONS. So the detailed maps of Britain, which actually are really useful and really important and totally central to all sorts of services, both public services, like, for example, ambulances getting around, and also commercial services. You know, it's what tech people would call like a sort of, you know, like a platform, I guess, or like a layer in the stack or something. Yeah, so mapping data isn't open. The ONS decided to charge for it. And as a result, Google and Apple came along and made their own maps and then gave those free to people and then monetized them. So basically, what I'm saying is that there's a commercialized version of this data, which does constitute surveillance. And then there's an open version in which the data, which is our public rights and our public inheritance, belongs to all of us. And yes, if use of that data to show people where to go, to sort of make all sorts of products that you know, that might help us and do different things, yeah, it would constitute some kind of what we might think of as surveillance. But it all depends whether that surveillance is accountable, whether it can be revoked, whether it can be challenged, whether we can sort of take ownership of it, and whether ultimately, I guess, it's public or private. And I'm not sure I've explained that very well, but that, I guess, is sort of, that's the difference between, it's the difference, but, you know, between, say, like the journalism in the public interest, which is what we do and what we try and do, and just shouting gossip about people, and also between the way that it's possible to know things about people and for that to be okay, and for that not to become part of a surveillance capitalism model which ends up exploiting people, also not providing the services for everyone on a neutral basis.
And my last question, because we've had a couple of dark moments, not least considering the future use of drones, and for people who can't watch, we're sort of sat in semi-light because the lights in this part of my kitchen aren't working, so it's a bit dark here anyway. But my last question to try and bring more light into the future aspects of the year ahead for all of us is to ask you what have been the best examples of tech being used for social good that you've come across since you took on your Sky beat?
What a good question. I can't think of that many stuff that I've come across on my Sky beat. And genuinely, I do find it really, really hard to think of examples, because somehow when you dig into everything, yeah, you end up finding out that there's a sort of dark undercurrent, especially in the way that the service might use your data or something like that. But the last thing I did before I left Wired was I went out to Ukraine to write a big feature about a procurement system called Prozoro. So Prozoro is like the most... It's amazing. It's the most transparent procurement system in the world. And that sounds like really, really boring. But procurement is everything. Like, procurement is where all the money is. You know, the British government spends, like, I think a third of all public spending is spent with private companies. That's procurement. And we literally, in the UK, we don't know where it goes. So it's a constant source of stories for journalists. They dig out some quote-unquote secret contracts that the government has done, you know, especially around Brexit. There's so many of those stories about secret contracts. Procurement data should be public data. And if it was public data, it's not just that we'd know about it, but you could have certain kinds of automation. You could have sort of certain, like, regulatory systems that will run automatically. And also, is that then what you find is that once you've got genuine data, open data about things, is that you don't always have to give every massive contract to IBM or Accenture, because actually SMEs, you know, startups, can get government contracts. And I'm such a nerd about this stuff, but that, seeing Prozoro in the flesh, in one of the most corrupt countries in the world, a place that is almost like barely a functioning state, and meeting the people who've built it and seeing what they've done, it was so sort of, yeah, it was so inspirational. And it really made me just, yeah, incredibly passionate about wishing that we could have something like that in this country, and thinking, yeah, you know, this is something that I want to tell people about, try and get people excited about procurement, or maybe, yeah, I don't know, one day.
Well, there's one very tangible example, which is the Seaborne Freight Company that everybody, the big Brexit contract for the ferries going out of Ramsgate, which is a procurement, and it's actually worthy of procurement corruption stories in various states around the world that we don't usually associate those sorts of stories with Britain, but that one doesn't look great on the tin, let's put it that way. Roland, thank you very much for joining me here in my kitchen in Peckham. It's great to do the first ever South London episode of Government versus the Robots. It's been great to have you here.
Pleasure, thanks for having me.
That's all for this week. My thanks to Skye Redman, as ever, for her help with the editing and production of this podcast. If you've enjoyed the episode, please do tell your friends all about it, send a few emails, and follow us on Twitter at @govt_vsrobots.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.